So, I want you to imagine a nation that just, intentionally decides to stop prioritizing its GDP.
Right.
Like they just ignore raw foreign investment figures, and they stop bragging about how many tourists step off cruise ships every season.
Which is pretty much the opposite of what everyone else does.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Picture a country that looks at those traditional scoreboards of success and decides they are just fundamentally flawed. Instead, this government starts measuring its actual wealth by like the health of its soil.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the psychological belonging of its youth and the literal security of the water coming out of the tap. We're talking about a complete radical redefinition of what it means for a society to be successful, moving away from those abstract financial numbers and toward the actual physical and social conditions that sustain life.
It is, well, it's a profound civilizational shift, really, because, I mean, for the last century, global governance has basically operated on the assumption that if you just make the economy bigger, human well-being will, naturally follow.
Right, the rising tide lifts all boats kind of thing.
Exactly. We've treated things like water security or community cohesion as like secondary side effects of a booming economy. But the framework we are looking at today flips that entirely. It argues that if you focus only on the abstract economy, you will eventually cannibalize the very living systems you need to survive.
And the specific blueprint for this shift is, well, it's what we are breaking down today. Welcome to the deep dive. We had this massive, highly detailed 2026 academic white paper, and it's titled St. Kitts and Nevis as a Life Coherent Island Commonwealth, authored by Dr. Bechara Saley.
It's a fascinating read.
It really is. The goal of this document is to provide a comprehensive national diagnostic and a transition framework for a small island federation. And I have to point this because it's so interesting. Before we get into the heavy mechanics of how a country actually changes its entire operating system, there's this fascinating meta detail right on the first page.
Oh, the AI statement.
Yes. The author includes a formal AI use statement. They explicitly note that an AI model was utilized as a collaborative tool for like synthesis and structural refinement, and this is key, the author retains full intellectual and evaluative responsibility.
Yeah, and that detail is just incredibly telling about the era we are in right now. Governance and policy design have become so complex, dealing with overlapping crises in climate, health, global finance. Synthesizing all that data is almost beyond single human cognition at this point.
Right, it's just too much for one person to process.
Exactly. Acknowledging the use of AI for structural refinement shows a modern, a transparent approach to managing that massive complexity. But the crucial part of that statement is the retention of evaluative responsibility. The AI didn't decide what is valuable.
Right.
The human author made the philosophical judgment that a nation's wealth is its life support systems, not its spreadsheet balances.
So it's like the human sets the compass and the AI just helps draw the map.
That's a great way to put it.
So let's look at the territory this map covers. We're looking at St. Kitts and Nevis. It's a relatively high-income, small island developing state. It has a strong national identity, functioning public institutions, and it has successfully adapted to massive global shifts before, like transitioning away from a centuries-old sugar economy.
Yeah.
So on paper, if you're just looking at standard global metrics, they're doing pretty well, right?
Well, if you look solely through the lens of income and institutional stability, yes. But the core argument of this paper is that this monetary wealth is actually masking a deeply brittle
I'm
foundation.
Brita Foundation here.
Right. The author looks under the hood of that high income and sees demographic and ecological realities that are just flashing red. The population is aging, household sizes are shrinking, which means, the traditional extended family support networks are thinning out.
Oh, wow. So the social safety net is literally getting smaller.
Exactly. And crucially, the country is structurally vulnerable to accelerating climate change and heavily dependent on highly volatile external revenues.
Which brings us to the central diagnosis of the paper, like the underlying disease that is causing this brittleness. The text calls it misnesting.
Misnesting, yes. And it's a brilliant conceptual lens. To grasp it, think about how any society is layered, right? At the very bottom, you have primary systems.
The physical stuff.
Yes, the living physical systems required for existence. So the water cycle, the topsoil, the health of the human body, the ecological integrity of the coastline.
Okay, that makes sense.
Right. And above that, you build secondary systems. These are the abstract, human-made constructs, finance, debt markets, gross domestic product, tourism revenue, or in the case of many island states, citizenship by investment income.
Okay, so money, basically.
Yeah.
Passports, tourism.
Exactly. Now, misnesting happens when a society structurally confuses the two. The secondary abstract systems begin to dominate, command, and eventually degrade the primary living systems they were, you know, originally invented to serve.
I was trying to think of how to explain this, and it's kind of like playing a complex strategy video game, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Up in the top right corner of your screen, you have your score. That's your accumulative wealth, your GDP, your government revenue. You spent all your time optimizing for that number, and the score keeps going up.
And you feel like you're doing great.
You feel successful. You think you're winning the game. But down in the bottom left corner, there's a tiny health bar. That health bar represents your water security, your youth belonging, your soil health. And because you are so hyper-focused on the high score, you don't even notice that the health bar is secretly draining to zero.
Right.
You are maximizing the abstraction while the actual life ground of your character is literally dying.
That captures the dynamic perfectly. The danger of misnesting is this illusion of prosperity it creates right up until the exact moment of systemic failure. And the paper doesn't just, you know, leave this as a high-level theory. It grounds it in very specific real-world examples currently playing out in St. Kitts and Nevis.
Let's get into some of those because they are fascinating.
Take fiscal abstraction, for instance. The government generates significant windfall revenues from its citizenship by investment program. This is essentially selling passports or residency rights to foreign investors.
And it's a massive cash injection.
Huge. But the problem identified here is how that cash is utilized. Instead of treating it as a finite, exceptional resource, the temptation is to use it to prop up normal, recurrent government spending.
Like paying teacher salaries or just keeping the lights on.
Exactly, which creates a dangerous dependency. You are using a highly volatile, external, abstract revenue stream to fund the baseline survival of your public sector.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Right. When the geopolitical winds shift, say, the European Union changes its visa rules, which instantly devalues that citizenship program, that revenue plummets.
It just disappears overnight.
Yes. Because the abstract system outpaced the physical life support system, the country is plunged into a fiscal crisis, forced into brutal austerity, and the public suffers.
Wow. And we see this exact same misnesting logic applied to the tourism sector, too. For decades, the global standard for tourism success has been binary. More arrivals equals better.
The more, the merrier.
Right. A cruise ship docks with, like, 5,000 people. They walk around for 6 hours, and the official metric logs it as a massive win for the economy.
Yeah, and if your only metric is gross arrivals and estimated visitor spending, you are engaging in pure tourism abstraction. What that spreadsheet ignores is the physical reality of the island's metabolism.
Which is what?
Well, 5,000 temporary visitors represent a massive immediate drain on local municipal water supplies. They generate tons of solid waste and wastewater that the local infrastructure has to process.
Right, 5,000 extra toilets flushing all at once.
Exactly. Furthermore, to feed those tourists, the hotels are largely importing foreign food, which means the foreign exchange you thought you were earning immediately leaks right back out of the country. The abstract economic metric grows, but the physical life ground of the island is actively depleted by the transaction.
That is wild. The most visceral example in the text, the one that really highlights the absurdity of how we measure economic activity, is health abstraction.
Oh, yes. This is a critical point.
The paper points to the enormous sums of money spent on downstream medical treatments, building these state-of-the-art dialysis units for end-stage renal failure, importing expensive pharmaceuticals to manage advanced diabetes and cardiovascular disease.
And economically speaking, building a new dialysis center is counted as positive GDP growth.
Which sounds so backwards.
It does.
Yeah.
But it generates construction jobs, it involves purchasing high-tech equipment, it employs specialized nurses, the abstract score goes up.
Right, the score goes up.
But biologically, sociologically, it represents a catastrophic failure of the life ground. The paper forces us to look upstream. Why are so many citizens experiencing renal failure in the first place?
Right, you have to ask why.
Exactly. It is tied to the influx of cheap, imported, ultra-processed foods. It is tied to a stressful built environment that discourages physical movement. It is tied to underlying economic anxieties.
I find this fascinating because it explains why politicians are, like, structurally incentivized to misnest. Opening a multi-million dollar dialysis wing comes with a ribbon-cutting ceremony. It's visible. You can point to it and say, look what I built for you.
Exactly.
But preventing diabetes through soil regeneration or, you know, better school lunches and walkable neighborhoods, that's invisible. You can't cut a ribbon on a heart attack that didn't happen.
And that is the absolute crux of the diagnostic. When a nation manages the collapse of its life capital through expensive downstream interventions, rather than generating life capital upstream, it is fundamentally misnested.
Okay, so if misnesting is the disease, and we are currently playing a rigged video game where our health bar is silently draining, what is the cure? How does a government practically flip this hierarchy right side up?
Well, the proposed cure is the adoption of what the paper calls the life coherence framework. This requires introducing a completely new vocabulary into the halls of government, starting with three foundational concepts that redefine what a nation is actually trying to protect and grow.
Okay, let's break those down.
The first concept is the life ground.
And to be clear for you listening, this isn't some airy philosophical metaphor. The life ground is ruthlessly physical and
right.
deeply social.
Yes, very grounded.
Right. It is the actual measurable rainfall. It is the salinity levels in the coastal aquifers. It is the biodiversity of the coral reefs acting as a barrier against storm surges. But it also encompasses the social requirements for life, right?
Exactly. The availability of meaningful work, a sense of cultural belonging, and literal physical safety in your neighborhood. It is the irreducible foundation. The second concept builds directly on its life capital.
Life capital.
Yes. This is the accumulated stored capacity for life to flourish.
Okay, let me pause you right there and play devil's advocate for a second. Because when I hear the term life capital, it sounds suspiciously like a rebrand of standard environmentalism, or maybe those ESG environmental, social, and governance metrics that massive corporations use to prove they aren't destroying the planet. Is this just putting a green veneer on standard development?
It is a vital distinction to make. And the paper is actually very aggressive about separating life capital from corporate ESG.
Oh, really? How so?
Well, ESG is fundamentally a risk management tool for financial capital. It asks, how will climate change or social unrest threaten our profit margins? It still places the abstract financial return at the center. Life capital reverses that entirely. It asks, how can our financial capital be deployed to increase the health of the aquifer or the psychological resilience of our youth? Life capital cannot always be rapidly replaced once it's degraded.
Because it's a physical reality, not a number.
Right. If a government mismanages a budget deficit, it can issue bonds or restructure debt. If a government mismanages an aquifer and it suffers permanent saltwater intrusion, no amount of newly printed money will make that water drinkable again.
Wow. That makes so much sense. It's treating ecological and social limits as hard physical laws, not just negative externalities on a spreadsheet.
Exactly. And the third concept ties this all together, the civil commons. The author describes this as the organized social immune system of a society.
The social immune system.
Yes. It is the shared infrastructure that ensures an individual or a family does not have to face the brutal shocks of life entirely alone.
So that covers what? Public education, municipal water grids, public parks, libraries, disaster preparedness protocols?
All of that, yes. When the civil commons is robust, a systemic shock like a hurricane or a sudden global inflation spike is absorbed collectively. When the civil commons is neglected and weak, those shocks bypass the collective defense and hit vulnerable individual households directly.
Okay, so to force policymakers to actually use these concepts, the paper introduces a mandatory decision-making tool. They call it the life capital test. Before any major public project, any foreign direct investment, or any new hotel development is approved, it must pass a gauntlet of 8 specific questions.
And these questions are designed to flush out misnested projects immediately. They ask things like, does this initiative protect or regenerate a basic life support system? Does it reduce our fragile external dependence on imported fuels or volatile foreign markets?
Right.
Does it prevent future repair costs? Does it strengthen the civil commons? Does it retain value locally rather than leaking profits overseas? Does it improve ecological integrity? Does it strengthen social coherence and safety?
And ultimately, are we leaving the next generation with more capacity or more debt?
Exactly. Does it improve intergenerational viability?
Let's run a hypothetical scenario through this test just to see how it works. A foreign developer comes to the government and says, hey, I want to build a massive 500-room luxury golf resort. It will create 1,000 construction jobs and boost GDP by 3%.
Okay, a very classic scenario.
Right. Under the old rules, that gets rubber stamped immediately. GDP goes up, everyone is happy. But under the life capital test, the government has to look at it differently. They have to ask, wait, a golf course requires millions of gallons of fresh water. Are you drawing from our already stressed aquifer? Mm. Are you importing all the food for your guests? Will your fertilizer one-off damage the reef that our local fishers rely on?
Precisely. And even if the GDP number looks amazing, if it degrades the water supply and leaks the profits, the framework dictates the project must be rejected or radically redesigned. You cannot sacrifice the literal life ground for a spike in the abstract score.
It's a complete paradigm shift.
It really is. And having established this philosophical and operational filter, the paper then translates this into 7 concrete national missions. And logically, it begins with the most fundamental requirement for biological and economic existence. Mission 1 is the Water First Federation.
I mean, you literally cannot build life capital. You cannot run a hospital, a school, or a hotel if you turn on the tap and nothing comes out. The paper identifies water as the master constraint of the nation. Now, St. Kitts and Nevis has historically relied on rainfall and groundwater. But with climate change radically altering weather patterns and causing more intense, prolonged droughts, water security has shifted from a municipal management issue to a core sovereign vulnerability.
Yes. And the text highlights a very specific recent infrastructure project here, the commissioning of a new desalination plant in the capital, Basse-Terre.
Right, which sounds like a good thing.
And the author acknowledges it is a necessary achievement. It provides immediate critical relief to a stressed population. However, the framework warns that treating desalination as a silver bullet is a dangerous illusion.
Because it's treating the symptom of scarcity without fixing the underlying disease of the system.
Precisely. If a government simply expands energy-intensive desalination without fixing the massive leaks in the existing municipal pipe network, what utilities refer to as non-revenue water, they are essentially pouring expensive, highly processed water into a sieve.
Just watching it leak right back into the ground.
Exactly. So the mission demands a holistic approach. You must patch the distribution grid. You must aggressively protect the natural groundwater aquifers from overextraction. You must mandate the revival of traditional household cisterns to capture rainwater.
Right, getting back to the basics.
Yes, and you must force the tourism sector, which consumes vast quantities of water, to become radically more efficient.
Which naturally bleeds right into Mission 3, which is renewable energy as fiscal medicine.
Yeah.
Because you really can't talk about water on an island without talking about energy.
No, you can't. The thermodynamic reality of desalination is that it requires immense amounts of power to push seawater through a membrane. And currently, the electricity grid in St. Kitts and Nevis is predominantly powered by imported fossil fuels.
So wait, if your strategy for water security is to build more desalination plants, and those plants run on diesel generators,
yeah,
what have you actually achieved on a macroeconomic level?
You have simply converted your water vulnerability into an energy vulnerability. Hmm. You have chained your population's most basic life support system to the extreme volatility of global oil markets and the geopolitical whims of petrostates.
Oh, wow. It's like realizing your roof is leaking, and instead of just fixing the hole, you buy a massively expensive high-powered pump to constantly pump the water out of your living room.
Right.
And to run the pump, you have to buy gasoline every single day using a high-interest credit card. It keeps your feet dry today, but it mathematically guarantees your bankruptcy tomorrow.
That captures the fiscal danger perfectly. This is why the life coherence framework reframes renewable energy. It is no longer discussed merely as like a global climate obligation or an environmental luxury. It is positioned as acute fiscal medicine.
Fiscal medicine.
Yes. The proposed transition actions are sweeping. It involves rapidly solarizing every possible public building, schools, clinics, administrative centers. It mandates transitioning the public transportation fleet to electric vehicles. It pushes for grid scale battery storage pilots.
So total overhaul.
But the crown jewel of this mission is the mandate to directly integrate renewable energy generation with water production. True national sovereignty is achieved when an island can produce its own fresh water using its own abundant sunshine and wind. Every single dollar that is no longer exported to buy foreign diesel is a dollar liberated to strengthen the civil commons.
That makes total sense. So water and energy are the foundational physical inputs. You need them to keep the lights on and the population alive. But how does the island manage all the other physical materials that flow across its borders? The paper uses a fantastic biological metaphor here, referring to the island metabolism.
Yes, a very apt metaphor.
This concept strings together missions 2, 5, and 6, covering food, waste, and tourism.
The term metabolism is highly intentional. A nation, much like a human body, ingests materials, extracts nutrients and energy from them, and expels waste. If the metabolism is linear and toxic, the body gets sick. Mission 2, food as medicine, farming as sovereignty, directly targets the pathology of the island's current food metabolism.
And like many small island developing states, St. Kitts and Nevis imports a staggering percentage of the food it consumes.
It does, which creates what the paper describes as a triple vulnerability. Let's unpack that. First, economically, high food imports act as a massive structural leak, constantly draining foreign exchange reserves out of the local economy.
Right. The money just leaves.
Second, biologically, the type of food being imported is highly problematic. We are talking about cheap, ultra-processed foods loaded with sugars and preservatives, which directly drive the explosive rates of non-communicable diseases, hypertension, diabetes, obesity.
Which ties back to the dialysis problem we talked about earlier.
Exactly. And the third vulnerability is socioeconomic. While the supermarket shelves are overflowing with imported processed goods, the local farmers and fishers are deeply marginalized. They struggle with unpredictable yields due to climate change, and they cannot compete on price with heavily subsidized foreign agribusiness. They lack stable, predictable markets.
The proposed solution here is just a brilliant application of state power. The framework basically says, stop trying to convince people one by one to eat better. Use the massive purchasing power of the government to fix the market. It proposes treating public procurement as an anchor market.
And this is a profound shift in logistics and public health. Think about it. The government runs hospitals, public schools, and prisons. They serve thousands of meals every single day.
That's a lot of food.
Yes. If the Ministry of Finance mandates that a significant escalating percentage of those public meals must be sourced directly from local farmers and fishers, you instantly transform the agricultural sector.
The mechanics of that are fascinating, though. Like, you have a hospital administrator who's used to just ordering a massive pallet of frozen processed food from an importer because it's cheap and it shows up on time.
Right. It's easy.
Now they have to coordinate with dozens of local farmers whose crops might fail if there is a drought. The state has to actively build the logistical bridge between the farm and the hospital tray.
It requires immense coordination, yes, but the systemic payoff is massive. You plug the economic leak by keeping those tax dollars circulating locally. You provide a guaranteed livelihood that encourages young people to actually view farming as a viable career. And crucially, you are feeding children and hospital patients fresh, nutrient-dense local food.
Right.
You are deploying food as upstream medicine, directly combating those costly non-communicable diseases before they require a dialysis machine.
Food is medicine, farming is sovereignty. I love that. But a metabolism isn't just about what you ingest, right?
Yeah.
It's also about what you expel.
Yes.
Mission 5 is circular island metabolism. The text highlights a physical reality that people living on massive continents rarely have to confront on a small island. There's literally no away.
That is such a key point. When you live in the middle of a massive landmass, the linear metabolism of import, consume, dump is hidden from you. The garbage truck takes the waste to a landfill hundreds of miles away.
Out of sight, out of mind.
Right. But on a 100-square-mile island, the consequences of a linear metabolism are immediate and unavoidable. The single-use plastic imported on Monday is clogging the drainage culvert on Thursday, exacerbating flooding.
Wow.
The untreated wastewater from a hotel development seeps into the coastal waters and smothers the coral reef that was supposed to protect the beach from erosion. The organic food waste dumped in a centralized landfill generates methane and toxic leachate that threatens the groundwater.
The waste loop is incredibly tight. It always comes right back to you.
Therefore, the mission dictates a forceful pivot toward a circular metabolism. This means scaling up municipal composting to divert organic waste from landfills and return those nutrients to the degraded topsoil.
Closing the loop with the agricultural mission.
Exactly. It demands infrastructure to treat and safely reuse wastewater for irrigation or landscaping, easing the burden on the municipal water supply. And significantly, it calls for instituting extended producer responsibility. The corporations and importers bringing packaging onto the island must bear the financial and logistical burden of its end-of-life management.
You really cannot discuss the island's metabolism without addressing the massive elephant in the room, tourism. Because tourism brings in huge volumes of material, energy demand, and human bodies.
Yes, it dominates everything.
So Mission 6 is dedicated to regenerative tourism. The framework insists that the state must stop measuring success by gross visitor arrivals and instead track net retained life value. A hotel must prove it operates efficiently regarding water and energy, buys local food, and contributes to the restoration of the local ecology, like the coral reefs or heritage sites.
Which is a complete reversal of the current model.
But I have to push back here on the pure market realities of this. If an island destination suddenly pivots and tells international tourists, hey, you can't just be pampered, unlimited consumers anymore, we expect you to respect strict water limits, and we're going to charge premiums to fund reef restoration, don't they risk completely alienating the market?
It's a valid concern.
Won't those tourists just book a flight to a neighboring island that still lets them take hour-long showers and ignore the local reality?
That is the standard fear, and it's what keeps destinations locked in a race to the bottom. But the paper argues that the global tourism market is fundamentally fracturing. Yes, you might lose the hyper-budget, high-volume tourist who only cares about a cheap buffet and an unrestricted tap.
Right.
But the goal of this framework is to aggressively pivot toward high-value, low-leakage tourism.
Swapping volume for value.
Exactly. There is a...
So far, we've talked mostly about the physical and economic metabolism. But the paper takes a brilliant turn in Section 5, arguing that a society's metabolism is also deeply social.
Yes.
If water is the physical life ground, the youth are the future life capital.
Mm.
This is Mission 4, Youth Belonging and National Service.
And the author delivers a very sharp critique here of how conventional policy frameworks view young people. Too often, bureaucracies treat youth merely as inputs in an education system or as statistics in a labor market.
Or worse.
Yes, tragically, as social risks to be managed through policing, surveillance, and the justice system.
They are viewed as a problem to be contained rather than a resource to be unleashed.
The life coherence framework completely rejects that policing model. It argues that when youth are alienated, when they lack mentorship, clear pathways, or a sense of belonging to their community, it is not a failure of the youth.
Right.
It is a critical failure of the civil commons. It is a symptom of a weakened social immune system. The youth are the literal regenerative capacity of the nation. If they are disconnected, the society has no future, regardless of its GDP.
And the intervention proposed here is incredibly ambitious. It's called the Green Blue Youth Corps. And the text is careful to distinguish this from those standard, uninspired make-work programs where governments just pay teenagers to pick up trash on the side of the highway to keep unemployment numbers down.
Yes, it's very different.
This is designed as a national belonging architecture.
It acts as the connective tissue for all the other missions, really. The Corps places young people into paid service, apprenticeships, and technical training roles that are directly tied to the physical survival and regeneration of the island.
Just imagine the psychological shift for a disenfranchised teenager. Instead of feeling ignored or policed, the government is essentially saying, we are facing existential threats from climate change, our water infrastructure is leaking, and our food supply is vulnerable. We literally need you. We need your energy and your hands to build our survival infrastructure.
And the mechanics of this are vital. You have youth brigades trained to detect and repair the non-revenue water leaks in the municipal grid. You have teams installing and maintaining solar panels on public buildings.
Wow, real meaningful work.
Yes. You have core members engaged in coastal mangrove restoration, which protects against storm surges. You have youth assigned to assist the aging population rebuilding that intergenerational household coherence. You have tech-savvy youth deployed to digitize government records and collect the environmental data needed for the dashboard.
You are simultaneously solving hard physical infrastructure bottlenecks while radically healing social fragmentation. You are building highly capable citizens who have a visceral sweat equity stake in the future of their own home. It's just a phenomenal concept.
It really is.
But this brings us to the most difficult part of the entire deep dive. Section 6, Rewiring the State. Mission 7 is Life Capital Budgeting and Sovereign Resilience. Because let's be honest, all these missions, solar panels, local food procurement, a national youth corps, they cost money.
They absolutely do.
How does a government practically navigate this transition without bankrupting itself? You can't steer a ship into a new world using an old map.
This is where the visionary philosophy meets hard bureaucratic reality. The paper argues that the central engine of government, the Ministry of Finance, must undergo a fundamental operating system upgrade.
Okay, what does that look like?
Well, the traditional way of evaluating a public budget is simple. Do revenues equal expenditures? The life capital budgeting model asks a much harder question. Does this allocation of public funds demonstrably increase the life capacity of the nation?
And this requires a very strict discipline regarding those citizenship by investment windfalls we discussed earlier, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yes, heavily. The paper draws a hard line between ordinary revenue, the standard predictable taxes used to pay the daily salaries of teachers and nurses, and patrimonial revenue.
Right.
A sovereign passport program is selling a piece of the nation's patrimony. It is finite and geopolitically fragile. The framework dictates an ironclad rule. Patrimonial windfalls must never be used to fund recurrent dependency. They must be legally firewalled and placed into a sovereign wealth and resilience fund.
So you take the volatile cash and you just lock it away.
You lock it into intergenerational savings, and you only draw down the yields to fund major durable life capital investments. You use that fund to finance the upfront capital costs of the renewable power desalination plant or to seed the Green Blue Youth Corps. You transform an abstract volatile financial flow into permanent physical life ground.
And the paper also introduces a concept that I think, honestly, every municipality on earth should adopt immediately: the national maintenance rule.
Oh, yes. It is such a pragmatic piece of policy.
It essentially makes it illegal to build a flashy new piece of infrastructure, like a new hospital wing or a new stadium, unless the government has already secured and ring-fenced the funding for its long-term upkeep and maintenance.
Because it attacks the political addiction to ribbon cutting. Politicians love the photo op of a new building, but nobody wants to campaign on a budget for changing HVAC filters and patching roof leaks 5 years later.
Exactly. So much less glamorous.
Right. But by framing maintenance not as a boring line item, but as an act of profound moral and intergenerational discipline, the framework prevents the slow, agonizing decay of the civil commons.
But to enforce this kind of discipline across dozens of government ministries, the leadership needs a totally new way to measure reality. Which brings us to the National Life Coherence Dashboard. Let me try to contextualize how radical this is for you listening. Imagine you are driving a car down the highway. For the last 70 years, the government's dashboard has only had one single instrument, a massive speedometer, which represents GDP. As long as the needle said you were going faster, the economists cheered, the politicians took a bow, and everyone assumed things were great.
Right, faster is better.
But what if you were going 90 miles an hour, but your engine is out of oil? The new dashboard being proposed here keeps the speedometer, but it shrinks it down and surrounds it with an engine temperature gauge, an oil pressure light, and a battery meter.
Hmm.
You might still be driving fast, but this new dashboard is flashing red, warning you that if you don't pull over and fix the engine, the entire vehicle is going to explode.
It is the ultimate tool for combating misnesting. The dashboard does not discard GDP or national debt metrics, you know. It simply re-nests them where they belong as secondary indicators.
Secondary.
Right. The primary focus of the dashboard is 12 tiers of life support metrics. It measures the life ground. What is the salinity level of the aquifer? How many days of water rationing did citizens endure this quarter? It measures household coherence, tracking the affordability of a locally sourced nutritious diet or the levels of caregiver stress.
Oh, wow. Caregiver stress is on the national dashboard.
Yes. It measures ecological resilience, the square footage of healthy mangroves, or the value of public assets exposed to sea level rise.
And the visual mechanics of it are designed for immediate public comprehension. It utilizes a simple traffic light system. Green means the metric is regenerating. Yellow means it is degrading and requires policy intervention. Red indicates a critical vulnerability that threatens systemic stability. But the most fascinating and subversive color on this dashboard is gray.
Yes, gray. Because gray represents missing data. In traditional political environments, missing data is viewed as a liability. If a ministry doesn't know the exact percentage of non-revenue water leaking from the pipes, or they don't have accurate statistics on youth mental health access, they tend to hide that ignorance because it looks like incompetence.
Right. No politician wants to stand up in parliament and say, "We actually have no idea how much of our food is grown locally."
Exactly. But the Life Coherence framework brilliantly weaponizes this ignorance. It frames gray data not as a political embarrassment to be buried, but as a top-tier governance emergency.
I love that.
The foundational rule is you cannot govern what you cannot see. If a crucial life support metric is gray, the immediate mandate of the transition unit is to deploy resources, perhaps utilizing the Youth Corps, to gather that data. It forces reality into the light.
This brings us to the final crucial section, the blueprint to reality. We have this beautiful philosophy, these seven vital missions, and a massive new dashboard. But how does a small, resource-constrained bureaucracy actually pull this off? Section 7 outlines the roadmap, moving from a 100-day sprint to a 10-year trajectory, ensuring this doesn't become just another brilliant academic PDF that sits unread on a server somewhere.
The author clearly understands that momentum is everything. The implementation begins with a highly focused 100-day mobilization. The goal here is not to fix everything at once, but to execute immediate, no-regrets actions that signal a definitive break from the past. Action 1 is establishing a cross-ministry life coherence transition unit,
which is mechanically very difficult. Bureaucracies are notoriously siloed. The Ministry of Agriculture doesn't talk to the Ministry of Health, even though their issues are biologically identical. This unit forces them into the same room.
Precisely. Action 2 is publishing the very first iteration of the National Dashboard. And the paper explicitly states that it is okay if this first version is incomplete and covered in gray indicators. The act of publishing the framework is more important than having perfect data on day one.
Just get it out there.
Right. Action 3 is producing rapid diagnostic briefs to identify the most acute vulnerabilities. And Action 4 is arguably the most important for public buy-in, launching 5 highly visible rapid execution pilots.
You have to prove the concept to the citizens quickly. Those pilots include designating the first water-first communities, launching the healthy local meals mandate in a select number of schools, solarizing a handful of prominent public buildings, deploying the first cohort of the Green Blue Youth Corps, and signing a zero-waste compact with a few willing hotels.
And once the 100 days prove that action is possible, the roadmap stretches into the 1-year to 10-year trajectory. By the end of year one, the Ministry of Finance is expected to release the nation's first life capital budget statement alongside the traditional financial budget. In years two and three, those initial pilots are scaled up into national programs. And by years 4 through 10, the ultimate goal is total institutionalization.
Meaning the philosophy just becomes the invisible, boring, normal way the government operates. But I mean, I have to throw a massive wrench into this pristine 10-year timeline. I want to talk about political cycle risk.
The vulnerability of democracy.
Exactly. Let's say the current administration does all the hard, unglamorous work. They lock the CBI funds in a trust. They enforce the maintenance rule. They publish the dashboard showing all the gray and red indicators. 4 years later, an election happens. A new administration comes in, and they look at this strict framework and say, this is too hard. We can't build our massive debt-funded vanity projects because of this maintenance rule. We want to go back to the old GDP chasing model because it lets us cut ribbons, hand out cash, and win elections. How does this framework survive the brutal gravity of island politics?
The author anticipated this exact vulnerability, and the text builds in specific structural guardrails against political regression. The defense mechanism relies on radical transparency and bottom-up accountability. By making the national dashboard public and easily understandable, you are giving the citizens the vocabulary and the metrics to judge their leaders accurately.
You are teaching the public how to read the new dashboard.
Furthermore, the framework mandates an annual life coherence report to Parliament, which forces these metrics into the official public record and mandates debate. It also calls for the establishment of community-level life coherence forums.
Yeah.
The logic is profound when a population truly understands that their literal water security, the nutritional health of their food, and the psychological future of their youth are the actual metrics of state success. It becomes politically suicidal for a new administration to campaign on abandoning those life support systems just to chase an abstract financial number. You make the protection of the life ground politically weaponized by the voters.
It shifts the Overton window of what the public will tolerate. So as we pull all these threads together, what is the ultimate takeaway? St. Kitts and Nevis already has an official policy aspiration to become a sustainable island state. But this white paper is pushing them to evolve past that buzzword, to become a true, life-coherent island commonwealth.
It represents an evolutionary leap in governance. It is the realization that simply administering government programs and managing debt is no longer sufficient in an era of climate breakdown. The state must transform into an active, disciplined steward of the living conditions that allow its people to flourish across generations. It requires recognizing that an island is bounded, relational, and deeply vulnerable, and that abstract wealth is meaningless if the physical foundation collapses beneath it.
It is a stunning, comprehensive blueprint for survival and prosperity. And while this paper is focused on the macroeconomics and governance of a sovereign nation, it leaves me with a final provocative thought that applies directly to you, the listener. Because the concept of misnesting doesn't just happen in the Ministry of Finance. It happens in our own lives.
It really does.
Think about your own daily routine, your own household, or the company you dedicate your time to. Are you misnesting your own values? Are you playing that rigged video game we talked about? Think about the abstract scoreboards. You might be chasing a slightly higher salary figure, a more prestigious job title, a specific number in your retirement account, or even a follower count on social media. We pour all our energy into making those numbers go up, celebrating every time the score flashes.
Yeah.
But while you are fixated on that top right corner, what is happening to your personal health bar in the bottom left? Are you quietly depleting your own physical life ground? Trading hours of sleep, exercise, and mental well-being to hit a quarterly target? Are you neglecting your personal civil commons, your relationships, your connection to your children, your presence in your community, just to maximize an abstract metric of success?
It's a tough question to ask yourself.
It is. It is incredibly easy to wake up one day with a high score in a game that no longer matters, only to realize you have bankrupted the actual living foundation of your life. If an entire nation can summon the courage to step back, recognize the illusion of the old scoreboard, and fundamentally redesign its dashboard for life, maybe it is time you take a hard look at your own metrics.